personal attention to me, but I do not remember a single event with her, nor does her face remain in my mind today. I do not know why this is, but it seems consistent with Father's reverent protection of her throughout all of his dealings with mankind. The odd thing is that it feels right to me that I do not remember. As powerful as I remember her love to be, I am spiritually content to know only what I know. Somehow, this is right. I asked my guide to show me the rest of the house. He agreed happily and took me to the corridor that ended in the smoky window. We walked side by side down the wide corridor and approached the glass. It was not transparent but milky-looking, with shifting colors that moved like smoke within the glass. Looking into it gave me the sensation that the glass extended to innumerable, far-distant places. He just continued walking, and I followed him right into the glass. I understood, as I passed through it, that it was a portal that connected distant places. It felt like we were still in my home, but were now somewhere far distant. The library. A second later, we stepped out into a room filled with people working at desks. Each desk had a large window before it with the same purpose as my room. They were studying the images and objects on the screen. Like my room, they could handle the objects, turn them, touch them, and experience them in every possible way. Books that they desired to see did not need to be read. Just touching the book and handling it communicated the full burden of information to them. One touch was sufficient, but longer exposure was delightful as it allowed one to experience the book in greater depth, enjoying everything about it, including the life and events of the author's life. If they held it long enough, they could experience every person who had touched it and everything about them. I remembered my own experiences and knew that there was a point where the information was not uplifting and the object was returned to the screen. I believe these people were like myself, recently departed mortals who were now continuing their search for light and truth. They were dressed in flowing white robes. Their faces were glowing with happiness. There were people carrying objects through the room, taking them to the people seated at the desks. The people here were all engaged and busy, but not hurried. There was a sense of eternity, but also a pleasant desire to learn as quickly as possible. They were all happy. This seemed to be a central library or information hub for people to learn. When they accomplished some level of learning, they received identical tokens of their education, just like those I had found in my chest. These were the objects the instructors were carrying through the room to present to the learners. As we walked through the room, there was a circle of light that preceded us. The people in each new place knew we were coming, who we were, and what our purpose and needs were. In fact, everything about us. The information about my guide was blocked from me, but not from the others in the room. I was never allowed to know who my guide was, nor where he was from. God, time, and law. It was shown to me that God does not dwell in a reality limited by time or distance. He exists outside of time and can move forward or backward through the construct of time. He created what we call time for our perception and progression, but he is not himself subject to it. Anywhere in his creations, and any when in his creations, he is there. He can and does act in the past, present, and future, but to him it is all now and here before his eyes. He can easily speed up time for his purposes, or stop it from progressing, all without our being aware of it. Since he can also see the end, eternal outcome of all things, and all people, he can influence or change anything, anywhere, and any time he desires to bless the eternal outcome of our lives. All of the things that we accept as mortal laws, like gravity, physics, light, heat, or speed, are all creations of God. We are bound by them unto life or death, but he is not. They are laws that belong to the celestial order. They function by his command and as he decrees, but he is not an inmate of the celestial order, and therefore he is not subject to these laws. When I first saw the Savior, he was standing above the earth, but was firmly anchored in his chosen place. These things do not violate the laws of nature, but operate above them in obedience to celestial laws. Father has ordained that time, as perceived by mortals, shall only go forward, but he himself is not subject to that edict. As I relate further in this book, As we grew close to the second coming, after we had labored to serve God for a long time and had acquired a greater measure of God's power as it operates in a millennial world, we began to have the ability to work without limitations by time or distance. It was the only way we actually finished the work assigned to us prior to His coming in glory. Returning to visit my body. The next awareness I had was being back in my bedroom at the foot of my bed. My body was still in the bed. I looked at the digital clock on my bedroom table. Exactly 1 hour had elapsed, though I had the sensation that we had been away for days and days. I knew that my body was dead according to the worldly measurement, but I was so thrilled with what I had just experienced that I wanted to wake up my wife and tell her everything I had just learned. Without verbal language, my guide told me that if I wanted to talk to my wife, I would need to go back into my body and this experience would be completed. I realized there was more he wanted to show me, and that it was not time to return to my body, but for some reason we needed to visit it, perhaps to keep the link between my spirit and body strong while he took me on further journeys in the spirit. I told him, "If you have more to show me, let us go. I'm ready." Chapter 6. Angels and Devils. Evil spirits and temptation. We didn't walk out the door. I just found myself in a different place. We were in a small home office. It was late at night. A young man in his underwear came into the room quietly, looking around him stealthily as he entered. He closed the door softly without turning on the light. He went to a computer and turned it on. As he waited for the computer to warm up, I felt a growing sense of excitement coming from him. I knew that his wife and 2 sons and baby daughter were asleep elsewhere in the house, and that he intended to view pornography. I understood this just by being in the room with him. As with previous experiences, I understood everything about him, his life, his decisions, his desires, his distress. I perceived that he was a good man, a returned missionary, and presently serving in his Quorum presidency. My guide said to me, "He is here to view pornography." I saw 8 spirits enter the room. 4 of these were evil spirits who had once been mortal. The other 4 were unborn evil spirits. Satan's minions. The disembodied looked human and wore clothing typical of the period in which they had died. The evil spirits were less substantial, generally smaller, with misshapen features, making them look slightly inhuman. They were agitated, active, jumping around in a frenzy, shouting their commands to the young man in excited voices. The disembodied spirits said little at first. They had little ability to be heard by the young man. They were there trying to satisfy the sexual passion they had developed during their own lives. There were both male and female spirits. Their sexual addiction had followed them into the spirit world. Their addiction was unending, painful, and impossible to satisfy. It haunted them. They were desperate to try and satisfy it endlessly. They were pleased that they were going to shortly experience it through this young man. They were intent, watching him, urging him on though he could not hear them. They were not looking at the porn on the computer screen. They were watching him closely, putting their faces in his face and screaming at him, mocking and taunting him. They didn't care about the images. They cared about sharing the body sensation of sexual gratification. The unborn evil spirits were there to trap him, to entice him on, to remind him of the upcoming thrill. They cared nothing for experiencing his passion. They had never had a body, and were not capable of understanding the thrill. They were there to control him, to make him obey their words, to keep him involved and under their spell as long as possible. They gathered around him, waiting for him to become fully involved in the sexual ecstasy he hoped for by viewing these images. The evil ones were reminding him of certain websites, urging him to go on, whispering to him how thrilling it was going to be. They told him which images to view and how he should feel about them. They argued against his conscience, giving him many reasons to ignore the voice of his conscience and carry on. They placed their hands on him time after time, causing him to feel thrill after thrill. They urged him as he clicked at his computer to seek after the thrill, to remember it, to need it more than anything else. They were most interested in keeping him focused upon his own body and his own thrills so effectively that he could not feel his relationship to Christ, the Holy Spirit, or remember his family. All he could think of was himself and the guaranteed gratification that was just a click away. The more excited he grew, the more frenzied the evil spirits became. They became more aggressive, jumping at him, hitting him with their hands and cursing. It was a loathsome thing to see. I realized even more powerfully from seeing this that all addictions are purely selfish. They guarantee the instant gratification of the flesh. Relationships are not guaranteed, and the gratification, the positive payback of the relationship, must be carefully maintained and worked at. This is the reason that people turn to addictions, because they are instant, require little work, and the results are guaranteed. It is also the reason evil uses them and promotes them so carefully, because they push the user away from all meaningful relationships, especially those with the divine. I understood that he had been awakened from his sleep by one of these tempters who had been influencing his dreams, urging him to awaken and need a sexual high. As soon as he made the choice to get out of bed and actually partake, the disembodied spirits had joined in. They were drawn to him like a moth to a searchlight in a dark sky. They came at once. By accepting the temptation and deciding to do it, he had given them permission to enter him and experience his sexual thrill with him. I saw many disembodied spirits competing to enter the room with him. The evil spirits remained at just four. When he made the decision to partake, all of his good intentions and desires were immediately drowned out by the passion and the control of the evil spirits. The good spirits that had been near him as he slept were forced a distance away until he could not hear them. Eventually they left, driven away by his choices. When he reached a pinnacle of lust in his body, a black tear or rip appeared at the crown of his head. At that instant, the disembodied spirits began to attack. They looked like football players tackling the guy with the ball. They were hoping to share just a moment of his physical feelings and excitement. They acted like hungry dogs going after the same carcass. There was fierce competition among them to be in him longer. They fought to be next, screaming and cursing, throwing each other aside to enter. As soon as one or two spirits entered, no more could enter. The evil spirit screamed and dove at him repeatedly until a weaker one inside was expelled and they took its place. It seemed to me that the ones who were expelled were exhausted, jerking on the floor as if they were in a sexual thrall themselves, mimicking the actions of the young man at the computer. I tried to turn my face away in disgust, but I could not. The image was before me, no matter which way I turned. The evil ones quickly recovered and rejoined the fight to re-enter over and over. The lust and addiction that these disembodied spirits had built up in themselves while alive as mortals still haunted them. They couldn't get rid of the lust because they did not turn to Jesus Christ, who could have healed them even after their mortal lives ended. Without His grace, they couldn't satisfy the powerful need of the addiction. They couldn't escape it. Without any way to satisfy the addiction, it caused them pain, and they hunted across the globe for any opportunity to experience the thrill again, and thus lessen their pain even for a brief moment. My guide communicated to me that when these spirits entered their victim's body, they could not fully feel what he felt. It was filtered or buffered to them. It was only partly satisfying, and they could not remain long because of the competition, so they attacked again and again. The disembodied spirits were surrounded by darkness, and as they passed through this man, the darkness they possessed went into him. He could feel it as waves of dark longing, and it urged him to seek harder and more thrilling porn, harder and darker images, urging him from soft images to violent, even perverse and vile. He resisted at times, and they screamed at him, throwing themselves at him in a frenzy. When the young man had entered the room, I knew from the light that came from him that he was a good man. I could see the light that he possessed being dimmed as he sat there. I saw that there was far more glee in Satan's minions that he was breaking his covenants than that he was viewing pornography. Their glee was greater in the fact that he was a good man than if he was any off-the-street kind of guy who did this sort of thing without needing much temptation. Their triumph was greater, their conquest was sweeter, and their control over him was more precious due to the fact that this young man had made covenants to avoid such things. They delighted in the pain that this would cause his wife and family, and they relished the opportunity to eventually afflict his wife with all the dark emotions she would feel that would separate her from the Holy Spirit. My last view of this guy was of him leaning close to the screen, breathing heavily, while unseen by him, the four dark spirits screamed at him to continue, and another dozen disembodied souls threw themselves through him in a frenzy of unsatisfied lust. One of the most tragic aspects of this scene was that these spirits from the unseen world were offering him a sense of false relationship, giving him the sense of being fulfilled and satisfied by this experience. He was beginning to accept these unseen visitors as his companions, and he was starting to enjoy having them, welcoming their influence in helping him to decide to partake once again in his secret world of filth. In the bar. The tragedy I felt for this young man was quickly driven from my mind as I found myself outside of a nightclub, looking at a line of young people in their 20s standing in line to enter. I could hear their thoughts. They were longing for the thrill that they hoped was inside. There were more disembodied and evil spirits there than humans. They were standing near the mortals, urging them to continue waiting, telling them of the thrill awaiting them. I next found myself inside. There were many people tightly packed on the dance floor, dancing closely, drinking, and smoking. I could hear their thoughts, which were a continual stream of obscenities, rationalizations, and sexual lusts. Much of their thinking was more vile and violent than how they acted. They looked like normal young people on a dance floor. If they could have heard each other's thoughts, there would have been no restraint at all, but an ensuing scene of bestial acts. I was both intrigued and repelled. I did not want to experience this darkness. I have never been to such a place and found this experience distasteful and disturbing. My spirit guide remained beside me, and I felt comforted by the fact that he did not seem affected by this scene. As in the line outside, there were more disembodied and evil spirits here than there were mortals. Just as with the young man viewing pornography, the evil spirits were focused on specific people, those who were thinking and feeling the greatest lust and thrall. They grew more aggressive in urging them to think darker thoughts and have stronger lusts. The disembodied spirits were waiting for specific feelings to arise in the humans. Some were looking for sexual fantasy, some for intoxication, some for drug-induced euphoria. Some were seeking violence and domination. When the humans reached a certain state of intoxication, or when they abandoned themselves to the instructions of the evil ones, an opening occurred near the crown of their heads. When it opened, it looked to me like a black tear in their spirit, similar to the young man at the computer. The closest spirit rushed at them and entered like fog being sucked into a vacuum. The other disembodied spirits rushed forward, pushing and fighting to be next. When an evil spirit entered into a human, they only remained for a few seconds, or a few minutes at most, depending on the ability of the spirit. When they were finally expelled, they seemed to squirt out of the body at random points. They seemed exhausted but satisfied when they came out. They came out violently, mimicking the actions of the human. When they realized they were expelled, they screamed and immediately jumped back into the spirit battle to be next. Once they were inside, they not only felt a limited portion of what their host was feeling, but they could be heard. Their dark passion added to the height of the thrall in their host. They urged their host to do things, to escalate the situation, to more aggressively seek greater thrills. I saw other disembodied spirits going around the room. They would pause and listen to conversations, watching people's behavior, trying to find someone most likely to feed their needs. It seemed evident that they could not read people's thoughts, but they were masters at judging and reading people's intent. They also listened to the evil spirits and what they were urging. If someone was successfully resisting the evil suggestions, the disembodied would move on. If someone was about to open up, many disembodied spirits converged upon them. The disembodied spirits were waiting for the mortals to be beat down by the evil minions. They were working together. The evil spirits wanted to spiritually destroy their targets so that they could obtain permanent control over them and cared nothing for the experience of the mortals. The disembodied delighted in the physical sensations of the mortals, but had no desire to dominate, only to prolong the experience. From the evil spirit's perspective, having a mortal yield to their temptations gave them power over the mortal. If they suggested an act, and the mortal did exactly that, they set their hooks a little deeper. They were not after the thrill, they were after dominion of the soul, and eventually lifelong control. They knew that if they could tempt with enough cleverness and deception that the humans responded, they would gain a little more control. This was their method, but their real goal was to gain enough control that they could keep the Holy Spirit from having any influence in the person's life at all. They weren't just trying to control behavior, they were trying to ensnare these people in the chains of hell. I saw that people who had already been entrapped by them could hardly hear their own thoughts. The voice of the evil ones had become even more powerful than their own mind. They would do anything their evil controller said, even while thinking it was their own idea or their own wishes they were fulfilling. Once these evil spirits had total control, then they desired that the mortal should quickly depart mortality, so that their possession became permanent. They thereafter urged them to risky behavior, acts of violence, and even suicide to hasten the day of their mortal death. The disembodied spirits were not trying to harm the humans so much as to share in their physical thrills and addictions. I saw spirits who were addicted to smoking try to snatch the cigarette out of the hands of mortals over and over, as if they could not understand why they could not actually grab it. Through this whole experience, I could not only see what the evil ones and the disembodied ones were doing, but I also knew what they were thinking, both spirits and mortals. It was more than I could stand, and the scene changed. At the horse race. I next found myself at a horse race. Now, I've never been to a horse race, and I had no idea what one was like. As soon as we arrived, all of the thoughts, emotions, and experiences of everyone there entered my mind with perfect clarity. It was a large track with large stands and thousands of people. There was a thrill of excitement in the air, which I quickly realized was being promoted by tens of thousands of evil spirits. Almost the same thing was happening here as at the bar. The evil spirits were working to enhance their control over the mortals by creating this great distraction. Even though the races were less dark and promoted less lust and sexuality by far, it still created an ideal circumstance for the evil spirits to urge them to high passions, desires, and fears, with soaring highs and crushing defeats, which kept them far removed from the Holy Spirit of God. The good angels were few in attendance here, being kept away by the mortals yielding their will to the evil ones. Many of the people at the track were there for the thrill of gambling, which was being highly promoted by the evil ones. Many of the people had lied or deceived to be at the track, and had opened themselves up to the evil ones in so doing. Some were there to drink, to deceive, and to satisfy their addiction to gambling. These were surrounded by evil spirits who encouraged them and told them what to feel, urging them to bet on certain horses, giving them a sure feeling of a win, which also guaranteed a crushing defeat. When they won or lost, the disembodied spirits pounced on them to share in the experience. Here at the track, there was a greater opportunity for the good angels to intervene. In the two previous experiences, the people were fully sucked into the evil of the moment. Here, some people were praying. Some were praying to win. Some to help with their addiction. Some were praying for help to know how to explain their losing so much money to their wife or husband. Even a thought of God, a prayer, a request, an intention to do good, an act of regret or kindness brought the good angels. They could then surround the person, protecting them from the evil ones for as long as that attitude persisted. There had to be some act of free will to invite the good spirits. Sometimes the bright angels whispered, "Leave this place." Sometimes it was a suggestion like, "You need to call your wife." Sometimes they gave them a memory, perhaps of a promise or an event from that person's life experience that encouraged them to make good choices. Then it was up to the mortal. If they followed the prompting, the minions of Satan moved on to someone else. Light began to grow brighter around the person, and the good angels spoke encouragement. They had a chance to think clearly and to escape. Entertainment. The scene changed again to several rapid views of mortals seeking various entertainments. I saw inside movie theaters and in homes where people were watching TV. I saw glimpses of amusement parks, casinos, and large sport events. I saw people listening to music from stereos and earphones. I saw people laughing at parties and endlessly hanging out with their friends. I thought these were everyday things of no spiritual significance. "Why are you showing me these things?" I asked. "What is the significance?" He replied that these were all of the ways that the people unknowingly moved themselves away from the Spirit of the Lord. I realized in each of these scenes that the good angels were absent or pushed away some distance. The people in these scenes were so involved in the entertainment that they weren't listening to the Holy Spirit. They weren't doing something evil, but they were not listening to God, which was what the evil spirits labored so hard to accomplish in others. Yet these were willingly isolating themselves. I also saw that evil spirits were urging them to view more and more violent or sexual content. They were urging the people listening to the music to become enthralled, to dance and shake and gyrate, to feel sexual or physical highs, to focus on their bodies and physical beauty, anything except God. I saw people obsessed with eating, with not eating, with dieting, with acting, with dancing or performing, with fashion or beauty, with sports, with dating, or with school, none of which were inherently evil. They were just so focused upon these things that the voice of the Holy Spirit, as I saw being delivered by the good angels, was pushed far away. Since we as mortals cannot often see the world of spirits, either good or bad, we are truly ignorant of most of what is going on around us. It requires some spiritual insight, usually gained by costly negative experiences, to realize how life works. Mortal life is only a dim reality. The angels live in an eternal realm, which is the brightest and truest reality. Mortal life will end. Their lives will not. They know how incredibly important this little time of mortality is, and because they love us and are in the service of their God, they labor to get our attention and lead us into a life that will end in glory. Spiritual gifts. I was shown how spiritual gifts work. There are good gifts, and there are evil gifts. We choose good gifts when we obey the Holy Spirit. These are gifts of love, joy, peace, faith, healings, prophecy, and many other gifts. When we repeatedly choose obedience to what is good, we create a spiritual link with Jesus Christ. He changes us into His spiritual likeness, and we grow brighter and brighter in this process until we become children of light, and we receive our wages from our Savior. We choose evil gifts by obeying the temptations of evil spirits, which is the same thing as saying to yield to a temptation from Satan. We choose evil gifts by obeying a lust to obtain some physical thrill or high. When we give in to any amount of evil, we are creating a spiritual link, like coupling train cars together. And when we allow this to happen over and over, we are changed, darkened, and dragged down, until we become servants of darkness, and we receive our wages from the master of darkness. I observe that there are many people who are governed by the voice of Jesus Christ, who are like lanterns being carried through darkness. They push the darkness away by their approach, and the dark angels must depart. Evil beings are powerless to penetrate it, and are compelled to depart. The same thing is true of people who are ruled by evil. They become lamps of darkness and push the light away. They become a force of darkness, even while walking in the brightness of spiritual day. Everyone who associates with them is darkened by them, and the good angels are powerless to penetrate it, until that person by an act of free will asks for help or prays for guidance. The chains of hell. I saw that when any person manifests even the smallest particle of faith, even just a thought or an idea, anything that moves them towards hope, obedience to truth, and faith in Jesus Christ, then the darkness is penetrated by a small degree of light, and the angels once again speak the words of Christ as the still small voice. If people choose to respond correctly to that voice, the darkness will begin to lift. The chains of hell are when a person becomes so enamored with their lives of darkness that they can no longer even hear the still small voice of the angels shouting truth from the distance to which they have been pushed. When a person yields to this degree, they lose their moral compass and can no longer tell the difference between good and evil, right and wrong, love and lust, and eventually mercy and murder. The only good they acknowledge is whatever brings them the fastest satisfaction of their lusts and addictions, and no price seems too high. The Ministry of Angels. I saw the angels of light who are assigned to us. They are real. They have direct access to Christ's guidance and are anxiously engaged in our lives. They remain with us throughout our lives unless we choose darkness by our thoughts, acts, or words. Their ability to direct, influence, and guide us is completely controlled by our choices. There are also more powerful angels of light who are assigned by Christ to bless us in certain times of need, as when I was dying in the hospital. These angels come on assignment, and in harmony with our assigned angels, they deliver the blessings Jesus Christ desires us to have. Every time I have had my eyes open to the world of spiritual things, there were more spirit beings in the room than mortals. Most of the godly angels seem to be our ancestors, people from our family who love us and who have been sent to aid us at special times. We don't have this more powerful type of angel with us often. They come on special assignment, and when there is a pressing need or greater blessing to bestow, we invite them to help us by rejecting temptation and by calling upon the name of God and doing what is right with a mind single to the glory of God. These guiding angels know us well because we have associated with them for a long time. Our familial relationship did not begin with their birth or ours. I sensed this eternal connection while I was viewing my premortal childhood home. Our relationships are ordained, and they are eternally significant. Our relationships began long ago in the household of God, before our birth and before the creation of the world. We have loved one another a long time and have served one another in unending ways. It is probably also true that while they were mortals, we lovingly ministered to them. And now they are ministering to us in the same office. Everything God does is according to law and according to agency. God does not gift us with things that we have not qualified for in some way. This is also true of angels. Some angels have greater abilities because of their greater diligence and because of greater righteousness while they were mortals. Some angels are learning, while others are quite accomplished. Some have great faith, while others are of less faith. Looking at this phenomenon from a parent's perspective, it gives us the ability to bless our children and grandchildren after we leave mortality. These spiritual gifts and strength become the heritage of our grandchildren, because when they choose the light, we are there waiting anxiously to pour out the gifts we ourselves obtained in mortality upon them. This is also the reason that drunkenness, abuse, crime, warmongering, mafia, and other dark traits that may corrupt political power run in families. These dark tendencies are passed down through the ages, when our ancestors find themselves in the next life as unhappy spirit beings who are still addicted, pain-racked, miserable souls. They seek to make others miserable like themselves. When their children and grandchildren follow their example, then the dark gifts are passed down through the generations. This may explain why some families have been royalty for hundreds of years, or wealthy and oppressive from the beginning of time, or any other dark familial trait. It may also explain why prophets and apostles tend to be related, and greatness runs in families. At last I realized that this was the message of this whole experience, to see how darkness infests mortality through evil angels, and how light is amplified in our lives through obedience to God and the ministry of angels of light. I started seeing glimpses of how people's choices were making this happen. Light, darkness, and the earth. I saw that the earth itself had been created perfect and is fulfilling the measure of its creation. Everything about it, its placement in the universe, the distance from the sun, and the bringing forth of life, fruit, and beauty, is all created by and maintained by the continuing presence of the light of Christ. People institute governments, false religion, false science, and false teachings. They build cities where evil easily thrives and provide universities and schools to promote such things. The entire collection of the philosophies of men, their lies, their religions, their rationalizations, and sins. As these constructs and pollutions of man spread across the globe, they cover the world with darkness, and the earth responds with upheaval, devastations, floods, famines, pestilence, and death. All of this is like a blanket of darkness that spreads itself across the face of the earth, dimming the light of Christ that reaches the earth. This diminishes the power that keeps the earth orderly and a fit habitation for mankind. There is a process given to the earth whereby it cleanses itself. When evil overtakes it, natural disasters, plagues, and upheavals begin in random places. When evil on the world becomes so great that the light of Christ is dimmed, it will produce eruptions, extremes of weather and temperature, storms, floods, earthquakes, and other destructive events. There is a direct correlation between the choices of mortals and the condition of the earth. That is why there will be so many natural disasters and death caused by these acts of nature in the latter days, because mankind by then will have veiled the earth in darkness. This isn't to say that the earthquake or flood is aimed like a missile at the evil, or that the places where disasters happen needed cleansing most. The whole of humanity suffers when darkness reigns. Enoch saw the earth weep because it was overwhelmed and covered by evil in Enoch's day. It wanted to rid itself of evil and rest in the millennial day. If it was tired and sick in Enoch's day, imagine how weary it is today. Immediately following this view of the earth and the effects of spiritual light and darkness, the scene changed once again. I began seeing the earth going through the prophesied latter-day destructions. The first thing I saw was the signs of the second coming being made manifest in the earth. These signs were in the form of events in the heavens and on earth. The most visible of these were the unending natural disasters. Other signs were wrongly interpreted by mankind to be expected but normal upheavals in the earth and celestial events among the stars and planets. I could see growing evil in the hearts of mankind. I saw that the earth was in great trouble. It was suffering, dying, losing its ability to sustain life on its face. It was like a tropical flower that had been moved into a basement devoid of all light and was dying in the darkness. It could not live without the light that gave life to everything and made it beautiful and useful to man. Every part of the earth was in great tribulation. Flying across America. I began moving across the world, flying as if I were in a fast helicopter close to the earth. I could see every detail below me. I was not in any machine, of course, but I saw it from that perspective. My spiritual companion was with me and guided our flight. We moved in and out of the cities across North America. I saw that whenever this time was that I was being shown, the financial structure of the world had completely collapsed. Every bank had closed down and money was worthless. People were learning to trade and barter. Manufacturing and industry were at a virtual standstill. There were no raw materials and no money to pay the workers. Factories and global businesses shut down overnight. All of the utilities were in chaos. People tried to keep the necessities of life running, but they were sporadic and mostly offline. There were blackouts everywhere, some of them lasting many months. Almost all water was not fit to drink because of acts of war against this country. People suffered everywhere. My flight across North America began in Salt Lake City. There had been a massive earthquake in that area in the fall of the year. I tried to determine which year it was, even while I was in the vision, but I could not. I looked into shop windows for a calendar or date. I even looked at people's watches to see if they showed the year. I was not allowed to learn when these things might happen. All I can say is that Salt Lake City looked in that vision much as it does today. There were models of automobiles that I did not recognize and other small changes, but I considered it as having happened not far into the future. The fault that runs along the Wasatch Front had moved dramatically, causing a great deal of damage to cities along the front. In the third part of this experience, which I will relate in the next chapter, I went back to Salt Lake City and found myself in my own life, in my own body, living through these very events. So I will come back to these events when I relate the third part of this visionary event. The next spring. I saw that the next spring, after the destruction in Utah, there was another devastating series of earthquakes that occurred along the west coast of North and South America. The western coast of California, Mexico, and all the way up to the tip of South America was shaken so badly that much of it broke away from the mainland and formed a series of islands off the coast. Seawater rushed in to fill the canyons between land and island. Major cities were shaken to the ground, with inland areas suffering less damage. The same quake extended up the coast of Canada and continued all the way to Alaska. I didn't see the effects of the earthquakes north of the continental United States, but I assume the destruction was undiminished. This earthquake sent tidal waves across the world. I was not shown what occurred in South America, Europe, Asia, or Africa, but I assume this was a worldwide catastrophe. From the events that I will relate in the next chapter, I assume that Europe was not as badly affected by the earthquakes as North America, because those countries sent large amounts of relief and supplies to America after the earthquakes. 2 months later. About 2 months later, another earthquake opened up a narrow canyon approximately where the Mississippi River is now, though it deviated eastward where the Mississippi presently merges with the Ohio River. It followed the Ohio into the Great Lakes. The Ohio River and the remainder of the Mississippi River rerouted itself into this canyon. It created a huge new lake and river system approximately where the Mississippi River is now. This canyon essentially created an eastern and a western United States, which figured into some international intrigue later on. I next flew over the lower part of California and toward the Gulf of Mexico. Almost all of California was in ruin, with less destruction further away from the coast. I saw that a great landmass had risen up into the Gulf. It extended from Mexico to Florida and consisted of a few large islands that replaced the water of the Gulf. I did not think to look toward Cuba. In some places, the new land meant Mexico, Texas, and Florida, but there was also a large waterway separating most of the new land from America. I did not see where the land came from. It either rose up from the Gulf floor or was pushed north by the earthquakes from South America. The land was not barren all over, but large parts of it had trees and other vegetation. Some parts of it were just muddy islands. I am at a loss to explain where it came from. This great landmass created a tidal wave that did a great deal of devastation as far north as Chicago. About two-thirds of the Gulf was now a series of large islands. I did not see the damage this caused worldwide, but I can only assume it was extensive. I then flew across the upper part of Florida and up the east coast of the United States. The earthquakes had not reached here as strongly, so the infrastructure was more intact. But there had been a biological attack, and there was more death in the eastern and northeastern parts of the country than in those areas stricken by the earthquakes. I saw bodies stacked in town squares and cities abandoned because of the stench of death. There were marauding bands of people plundering and stealing in every major city. They were murdering everyone they found to preserve remaining resources for themselves. It was like survivors in a lifeboat throwing the weakest among them overboard to leave enough food and water for the strongest. It was a gruesome scene. The scene was violent and disgusting. During the writing of this book, I was shown the text of President John Taylor's vision of similar events, where starvation and death were everywhere. I was startled by the similarities, though the suffering was seen more graphically in President Taylor's vision. See Appendix A for the complete text of the dream. Foreign troops. I saw foreign troops landing on the east and west coasts of America. There were tens of thousands of them. They came in large ships, some of them former cruise ships with naval escorts. They landed with thousands of vehicles, most of them laden with relief supplies, but also with large tanks and missile launchers. They wore blue-green helmets, and I assumed they were international relief troops. My mortal body is colorblind, and I am not sure if I saw the color of these troops' helmets correctly in the vision. I didn't see many troops in the large cities like Boston, Chicago, and New York, because there was almost nobody there to relieve. Those who had not died were trudging west to escape from the cities. In California, some Americans tried to fight the troops because they saw them as invaders. There were a few battles where the local people lost the battles and were subdued. The foreign troops did not punish the survivors. They just asked them to cooperate, fed them, and released them. This won over the minds of the people. They also saw that the foreign troops had come with the expectation that they would have to kill locals, even though Americans were in no condition to resist them. Chapter 7 Tribulation and Fullness. Earthquakes and Floods. My next realization was that I was in my body, standing in the parking garage beneath the present church office building. What I mean by in my body is that I was no longer flying across the continent, but I was now a participant in the vision. It once again felt real to me. I had possession of all of my senses and was experiencing these things in perfect detail. As in everyday life, I was subject to the events around me. Even though what I saw next has yet to occur, I was nevertheless there, dressed in a business suit, carrying a briefcase, and walking through this familiar underground parking garage. I had parked there many times when I had attended my monthly meetings appertaining to my calling. In my new circumstance, I remembered that I was just walking from a meeting with a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. I was feeling content, with the Spirit warmly present upon me. I had just reached my car, which was a different vehicle than the one I presently drive, in 2011. I had just about reached the car door when the ground started shaking violently. I thought, "This is a bad earthquake. I don't have time to get out of this parking garage with my car. The building will fall on top of me before I get out." I was only 20 or so feet from the exit, so I dropped my briefcase and ran for the exit. The ground was rolling violently beneath me. I fell down many times, but when I stood, I was not injured. I reached the road, which was North Temple, only to see water gushing up out of the ground. I have to pause in my narrative a moment to say that I have been sick all of my life, and running even that short distance would normally have exhausted me. But in this vision, I was not tired, not injured by repeated falling, and not particularly afraid. I realized I was different. My body had been upgraded in some indefinable way. Even though this all felt real, I knew I was experiencing a vision, and I wondered if my upgraded body was an effect of this vision. I didn't understand what I was being shown until much later. Now back to North Temple. The earthquake had broken up the streets, and where there were cracks in the road, water was shooting into the sky. Water was also gushing from manhole covers, storm drains, and cracks in the earth. It was shooting up with sufficient force that water was spraying everywhere, completely soaking me. It was fresh water, surprisingly clean and clear. Everywhere I could see there were geysers of water spraying with a deafening roar into the air. I asked myself, where is all of this water coming from? I can only guess at the answer to this question. I turned east and ran uphill. Water was roaring down North Temple in a flood, which grew deeper each moment. Water was now up around my calves, and I ran uphill against the current with surprising energy. The eastern side of Salt Lake City is several hundred feet higher than where the temple sits, and I was running for high ground. The ground continued to heave, and I fell down many times, but each time was uninjured. I saw cars with people in them being swept down the street along with furniture, parts of homes, dead bodies, and trash of every type. It was a sickening scene. There was nothing I could do to help them. I fell one more time and was myself swept away in the swirling flood. I held on to debris and kept my head above water. All of this time, I was wondering where all the water was coming from. The water was shooting up about 6 feet into the air. It was all astonishing. I found myself flowing west toward the old Union Pacific train station. There were people standing on the stairs watching the flood flow around the building, trying to help anyone that floated near. I floated toward them, and someone pulled me onto the stairs, and others helped me stand up. I found that my trousers were ripped completely off me. I had no shoes. I was standing there in my shirt and tie, socks, and underwear. The train station was flooded by about a foot of water, which went down to a few inches as the hours passed. The survivors with me included women, children, and men. We watched the flooding until the sun began to set. We realized we were going to spend the night in the station, and we tried to prepare a dry place where we could sleep. We tried to sweep the water out of the places we needed to be, and we packed blankets under the doors to try to hold back the water that was still flowing over the sill. To me, the train station felt like a sinking boat just before it goes under. There were still a few inches of water flowing over the tunnels. We found dry places and sat on the wooden benches to try to get dry. I remember being quite cold and trying to sleep on these benches. In one of the storage areas, we found some small blankets, probably left over from the days of passenger trains. We also found tiny pillows, previously used for sleeping on the train. We huddled together and tried to cover ourselves with these. Someone found a storage room filled with workmen's coveralls. They were faded blue, like a janitor's uniform. They were clean, but not new. I also found a pair of shoes that almost fit. The next morning, we found that the floodwater was going down. There was a lot of pooling and an amazing variety of debris everywhere, including dead bodies and body parts, which was disturbing. I engaged myself in helping those in the train station, trying to provide for our immediate needs. Someone found a kitchen and some kind of mush, which we mixed with water and ate cold with our fingers. All telephone and cell services were down. There was no electricity or running water, so we were truly in the dark. At about 2 or 3 that afternoon, I decided to make my way back home. It should have taken me half a day of brisk walking, but my journey took 3 full days because of the devastation, the breakup of the roads, and the fallen trees and buildings. I had to keep detouring. Anytime I found someone in need, I joined them in their work. They offered me food and assistance as I made my way home. The devastation was awesome and terrifying, but there was no looting or selfishness. The city had changed. Old landmarks were gone. I found myself disoriented because signs, buildings, and even trees I had used to guide myself home for many years were now gone. I had to keep asking for directions and to find out which roads were open. I traveled south a long distance before I could again turn east for a while, and then north back towards my home. I probably walked 20 miles to cover 5. I looked up and saw that the mountain behind the city had collapsed. The tops of the mountains had fallen upon the upper parts of the city, burying most of the large homes on the benches above the city. When I finally made it to my subdivision, I walked up the street I lived on. I could see no people anywhere. They had all abandoned their homes. The houses were shifted and pushed off of their foundations. My house was so twisted that I could look down into the basement from outside. I realized that it was no longer habitable and was dangerous to enter. I did not find my wife or any family members. I went back later with help and went down into the basement to recover our food storage and a few personal things, but I never did enter the upper part of my home. I just walked away. The whole quake had lasted only 6 to 8 minutes, but it felt like hours. The floodwaters rose for about 8 hours and then began to subside. After that, water remained in the streets and pooled in low places for several weeks. The pools of water quickly became fetid and septic. There was water flooding into Salt Lake City from the Bountiful area. I'm not sure if a reservoir had burst or what might have caused that. There was flooding from the south where the Jordan River was running over its banks, I presume from Utah Lake being inundated by water from the reservoirs above Provo and other areas. All of this water drained into the Great Salt Lake, moving the salted water in a tidal wave out into the desert northwest of the lake. The lake was at least twice the size that it is now, and had risen about 12 feet in depth. Low-lying farms and homes were gone. In some places, water was covering I-15. The whole airport area was flooded, and it was months before military planes could land there. I don't believe commercial air services were ever restored. Most of the inhabitants of the area generally did not believe that this was a sign of the coming of Christ. They just considered it a natural disaster. A strong core group continued to listen to the Holy Spirit and to believe and correctly interpret the signs we were seeing. But there were many, both in the church and out of the church, who were angry, were despairing, and had little hope. The leadership of the church was stricken just as hard as the general population, and since all communication was down, it was several weeks before we heard anything from the official lines of the church. Those members of the 12 and other quorums who had been away on assignment were cut off by the collapse of communication worldwide. The first thing we knew of the church was that some of the food we received from the foreign troops was marked with the church logo. This comforted us, but it was still weeks before we were assured that the church leadership and its local and international organization had not collapsed altogether. We didn't know if the prophet or any of the 12 had survived. This scared many people and prompted some to stand up to try to reorganize the church according to their own ideas. Those who had the Spirit knew that the process of rebuilding the church and restoring the quorums of the priesthood was underway, but we knew almost no details. The church's reorganization was hampered initially by not knowing who had survived there in Salt Lake City and across the globe. Without the voice of the prophet among us, a feeling of discord and strife grew in the church. People grew angry about almost everything, and some were selfish with the remaining resources. However, many were stalwart and faithful through all of this discord and strife. The local churches of all denominations, including stakes and wards, rose to the occasion, organizing relief efforts among their people, housing and feeding them, providing comfort and safety. The church had a prominent role in the rebuilding effort because the church and her people were so well prepared, but every other church joined in a united effort. I was among those who went door to door, digging out the survivors and burying the dead. Sometimes we were moved upon to give priesthood blessings, and those who had faith were saved, some with miraculous recoveries. But mostly we buried the dead and brought food and water for those who were without means. I was actually amazed at how many good Latter-day Saints had little or no food storage. We didn't judge them. Those with faith who had stored food gave it away freely and joined the work of saving those who suffered and of preparing for the fast approaching winter. We rushed to close in the damaged homes and to find a means of heating the homes. We took materials from damaged homes to repair the standing ones. Many families moved in together into one home. It was a Herculean effort. About this time, a large column of military vehicles arrived in town. They had come to help. They wore blue helmets and had international insignias on their doors, helmets, and uniforms. Our local civic leaders had tried to organize relief efforts, but that effort expired when the foreign troops took over. Only the church and our Christian friends remained organized and committed. The foreign troops were from many nations. Most groups didn't speak English at all. There were groups who looked Asian. We couldn't tell from their language or from their uniforms because they were all dressed alike. There were troops from European countries as well, but none from England that I met. There were also American service people from what remained of the U.S. Armed Forces. Depending upon their rank, they were sometimes the leaders of these divisions, but most of the time they were not. They came in large, strange-looking trucks, much larger than those of our present military. Some of the trucks had 4 or 5 driven axles and were too wide to drive down a single lane of highway. They had come from the west coast of California and made their way across a large area of devastation. Their vehicles were covered in mud and showed evidence of harsh use, but seemed rugged and reliable. The trucks were loaded with a great deal of cargo, food, medical supplies, fuel, and other necessities. We were grateful to see them arrive, but it was unsettling just the same. They took over several schools as their headquarters and used the gymnasiums to store goods, which they guarded closely. They also set up hospitals with real doctors. They were soon overwhelmed by the injured. Those of us who were uninjured volunteered to help with the work. They were surprised by how many came to help. They gave us gloves and coats and welcomed us. They found heavy equipment and soon began digging large graves in the schoolyards. There were many former missionaries among us, so we were able to communicate with these new arrivals to some extent. They informed us that much of Europe, Asia, and Africa had been spared from the major effects of the earthquakes and tidal waves. Most of the devastation had occurred in North and South America. They said they had arrived in California in hundreds of ships and had immediately worked with those people to stabilize things, and then they headed east. They told us that a large relief effort had landed on the East Coast and was working west. We learned that every major city they had come to was devastated. They reported, as I had seen during my flyover vision, that the California coastline had broken off into a series of islands. They also told us that more troops and supplies were on the way from all over the world. They said to us, "America has always been generous to us in disaster relief, and now it is our turn to respond." They seemed genuine in their desire to help, but I could not see light in their faces, and I deeply distrusted their long-term objectives. I think most of us felt that way. Not many days after they arrived, they began clearing the streets of rubble and overturned cars so that relief efforts could move more efficiently south. I was on one of the first big trucks when we headed south to see how far we could get beyond Salt Lake City and what relief efforts were needed there. Initially, the foreigners, and especially